and I'm your guest host from Canada, George Freund. Joining us for this hour is going to be one of the Zero Hedge Men, author of The Ford Men, Christopher Whalen, an investment banker from New York City, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, LLC, who works as a consultant and analyst focused on financial issues, mortgage finance, and related technology companies. And we're glad to have him aboard. And I guess you know what I've been doing for the last couple of days is pouring through Ford Men, and I find his writing abilities to be just top-notch. You're not going to fall asleep or get taken off onto weird tangents. It's focused, to the point, interesting, revealing. He's a very good author, in my opinion, and I really enjoyed going through his book, and I highly recommend it to everyone. Welcome aboard, Christopher. It's good to have you here on Power Hour Nation.
Thanks for having me, George. Beautiful day here in New York after torrential rain. So,
yes, you have the curse too, then.
Oh, the reservoirs are full. Sadly, we can't get them to, you know, sweep away Andrew Cuomo and our beloved mayor, Bill de Blasio, who are both a disaster. But the sun is shining, and that's what we got to look at. So.
Yeah, I think they found a way to tax it, and that's why we're getting a ration. It's just, field it a little bit, and then we'll figure out a way how to tax it off you. But it is so nice to have it the last couple of days. I went for a good long walk on a roof garden to stretch my legs and get some vitamin D, and, it was just nice to have along after
that's
the
right.
Monsoon season.
So exactly.
Let's get into the Ford Men here. This is, a lot of history is because it's old. We're unaware of, even having to go out to a car and put a crank in it and wind it up and get it started, or to go back to the very beginnings because, the automobile just changed the world, really, and Ford was at the forefront of that. But, if it wasn't for other people, Henry Ford probably just would have been an old crank cursing in a garage somewhere and waiting for another inventor to come along and put something in the marketplace. He had some, serious people behind him who really helped his third attempt at a company to get off the ground. And, one of them was even a Canadian as well. So,
Oh, there's lots of Canadians in the story. It's fascinating. But, yeah, no, look, why do we have Detroit? Detroit is there because many European immigrants, especially the Irish, that is where the Ford family came from, came by boat, and they ended up at the choke points of the Great Lakes, and they needed a wagon. So the auto was an evolutionary step. It wasn't new. It was just a wagon with a motor on it. And that's exactly what Ford built. The Model T had wooden spoke wheels, and it was kind of like a tractor, and it had belt drive, as E.B. White noted in his wonderful little book about, it's called Farewell to Model T, because he had one. He said it was never quite out of gear. It was always, it wanted to lurch forward, and it was just a fascinating machine. But, Ford had the vision that said, we need this, and it became popular because it was so useful. This is what it comes down to. But the story of Ford is really a great one because it teaches you that you do need partners and you do need luck. You need lots of luck. I mean, Ford could have defaulted three times in the last century, and he didn't. And you got to just conclude that the Almighty likes the Ford family. Because, GM was supposedly better managed, and they had Alfred Sloan, rational management. They were the favorite of the U.S. government in World War II for building tanks and planes, and yet somehow they defaulted three times in 100 years. So go figure.
Indeed.
But it's a wonderful story, too, because it reminds you of all the significant people that were part of that age. But, yeah, go ahead, George. What were you
going to
say? Well,
it's like any team. Like if you have a sports team, someone can get the touchdown or score the goal, but there's a whole lot of people behind you that are helping you move the ball, the buck, and they're the trainers and, owners, investors, the fans, like everybody's there. And, that's all part and parcel of it. And just to say that, there's only one survivor left to the story is a very poor story. And, when I was reading about Mr. Cousins.
The PR department at Ford Motor was quite formidable, and they had some great ad men who actually came and worked at the company, Mr. Ferry, for example. But, I think the part about luck is so important because You know, just quickly to remind everybody, or just tell them for the first time, Ford's third go-round of a company was funded by a coal dealer named Malcolmson, and he wanted to get into the business, but his creditors wouldn't let him. The bankers who funded his business said, no, you're staying with the coal business. So he ends up putting his clerk, James Cousins, at Ford to, you know, keep an eye on Henry because he had a terrible reputation as a tinkerer and a racer and, you know, not a good businessman. So, you know, the long and the short of it is one day Jim Cousins puts an ad in the newspaper. He says, we're selling cars. And Henry Ford never would have done this because he was constantly refining and improving the product, right? He had no commercial sense at all. But James Cousins said, we're selling cars. And the response was amazing. And there was no factory at the time. So the Dodge brothers, Horace Dodge, who was one of the original investors in Ford Motor Company, made the original Fords as kits. And they were really the first parts maker for the auto industry in that early, early part of, you know, the 1900s. So, you know, there were all these different pieces that came to play that made it a success. And you can't say it was planned. If anything, maybe by divine intervention, but it was a matter of luck and the right people at the right time that got it all going. And I think particularly having people like Horace Dodge sitting on the board and as part of the early nucleus, you know, the Dodge brothers are forgotten other than the company today, but they both died of the Spanish flu in 1921. And had that not happened, the auto industry would look very different today. I think they might have ended up consolidating the whole thing. But fate took them, and we were left with Henry and a crippled General Motors. It was by that time being run as an appendage of the DuPont Corporation. So, you know, the auto industry is big, and the public loves it. But, God, it was a mess. It's a miracle any of them got through World War II. So, you know, there you are. But Henry Ford, like I say, that company could have easily defaulted several times in the first 50 years, and somehow it didn't. Quite amazing. Roosevelt tried to get them. FDR hated Henry Ford. It's a miracle they survived that whole period. But General Motors didn't want the government to take over Ford because they realized they needed a competitor. They didn't want to be the only automaker. And that's essentially what would have happened if the government had taken over Ford in, you know, early part of World War II. So it's a great story. There's all sorts of characters back then and even today.
Well, Mr. Cousins and Ford had a big falling out. What was that all about?
Well, I think Jim Cousins outgrew Henry Ford. Ford was getting more into politics. He was by then dispensing some of his anti-Semitic creeds that were, you know, came to him through our friends in Great Britain, ironically enough, according to my research. And Cousins was a very wealthy man. The tiny bit of money that they had assembled was paid back in year one. So by the time it gets to 1913, when the two men split, Cousins was one of the wealthiest men in the country. And he was haunted by that. He got into politics in Detroit first and then eventually became the great senator from Michigan and would later on try to reason with Ford. But the two men were estranged for many years. But it was a big negative for the company when Cousins left because there was no one to gainsay Ford at that point. He had forced all the other partners out, and he was just kind of isolated there by himself running a plantation and one product, the Model T, and he would constantly try and reduce the price, while meanwhile General Motors was giving their customers credit and offering them many different products. So the divergence between the two businesses is fascinating. No credit at Ford until after World War II, whereas General Motors realized that if they gave their customers credit and they financed all their raw materials on the input side of the equation, that they would need no working capital. And that's how the company grew to such enormous size. So, you know, very different business. Ford was run on cash. He literally paid for everything in cash or by check. And there were no financial records of Ford until after he died. The company had to literally assemble a financial picture in the 40s after the war ended in order to do an offering which was done not for the company. The company didn't need the cash, but the Ford Foundation that was created to help the family survive the Roosevelt era inheritance taxes had to sell stock. They had to diversify. And that's where the Ford Foundation came from. That was the brilliance of the Goldman partner, Sidney Weinberg, who was the banker to Edsel Ford and his wife. But it's just a fascinating tale. They literally had to assemble a picture of this company that had existed for 50 years. But,
oh, my goodness.
You know, there were just no financial records at all.
Well, you'll wonder where the money went. But one thing that some of the things, little factoids that really impressed me were the fact that Henry Ford ran his own basically private intelligence agency with his company. Part of it was to be anti-union, but I'm sure at other things he was getting into geopolitics or national politics and trying to exert influence as far as he could possibly exert influence. And that is an interesting little point, and the fact that the Ford Foundation was used as a propaganda organ for the CIA as well just floored me as well, and I recognized that classic old name, Richard Bissell, when I was going through that part to say, mm-hmm. you know, okay, wow.
Well, so, yes, they used many corporations in that era, to be fair. The CIA even used to put people in the Foreign Department of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, because it was considered foreign, and that was okay. But multinational companies that had international departments, oil companies, manufacturing companies, would routinely provide credentials to American intelligence operatives and just pretend that they were employees. So there's nothing new there. I worked for a couple of gentlemen at the Fed in New York that I'm sure are getting more than one pension. And that came from World War II. There were a number of senior officials at both Treasury and Fed in those days, 70s, the 80s, who had all worked for the OSS or all worked at Treasury during that period. So it was not uncommon. But, you know, the really unfortunate part about the link between Ford and the intelligence community is that I think the protocols of the Elders of Zion came through a Cossack named Boris Brasov, who was hired to be Ford's personal financial secretary, basically take care of his checkbook. And this man had worked with Sidney Reilly, the famous British spy who tried to overthrow Lenin and then came to America with the rest of the Russian diaspora and operated in New York for a time. And when I was doing my early research, I'm a big fan of Reilly, I noticed that Mr. Brasov had an office down at 120 Broadway. And I thought, oh, what's the odds that Sidney Reilly and this Cossack didn't know each other? And, of course, they knew each other. They had worked together. So I just wonder if the British Secret Service didn't deliberately give Ford that hateful document that he then published. You know,
yes, there could be no other conclusion, I think. It was delivered.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, Ford, there's a wonderful scene in the Thames series on Reilly at the end where they actually dramatize a meeting between Reilly and Henry Ford. And I could never get Ford to confirm whether that occurred. And then finally the librarian told me that there had been a fire. And all the documents from that period were gone. And I thought, oh, how convenient.
But when you look at this chap as well, he was a prosecutor on some kind of show trial involving mm-hmm. the murder of a young Jewish boy. And it seems that all the evidence is made up and that he's trying to convict a Jewish man for a crime that he didn't commit because he had the perfect alibi. He was at work signing documents on the Sabbath. So everybody saw him, knew he was there, and that they're still trying to orchestrate a conviction against him. So it looks like this Brasov chap, was making this up, and it was supposed to be based on things that you'd find in elders, that he was involved with some kind of cult that drinks the blood of young children or something like that. So if he's making up that story as a prosecutor,
exactly,
and he's providing a written material, the elders, well, it follows the same plot line to a degree, and basically you can see that this is, you know, some type of psychological operation that's being inserted at a very high level in American business infrastructure at, you know, basically a building block time where, the British government as an intelligence service would want to go after the communist country in Russia, looking at them as the greatest threat to the world, and maybe trying to get some type of impetus to get involved in forming armies and taking action against them. Or at least the other big thing that Sydney was dealing with, too, is the loan that was going to go to Russia from the United States, as they were trying to impede this loan. And, you know, so you need good propaganda for that, I guess, and you shouldn't loan money to the boogeyman, although turns out he was the ultimate boogeyman.
Well, that's right, and they took advantage of Ford and these other business types. And you know, Riley ultimately died in order to defrock the double game that the communists were playing. They had set up a bogus opposition group, which was supposed to be funded, and they had approached Ford and others for this project, right? But Felix Dzerzhinsky, the head of the Cheka, was much smarter than they were, and they needed cash. Obviously, the revolution was quite strapped, and they ended up getting the cash from the very people who wanted to overthrow them. So, you know, Ford got involved in foreign affairs, and he had a peace effort to try and keep the U.S. Out of the war and everything else, but he never really was a significant public figure because he didn't like the public. He didn't like to appear in public. That was not his thing. And, you know, if he had had the affability of his son, Edsel, he might have been one of the great men of the 20th century, but he just wasn't that way and ended up, you know, being, I think, more of a crank than anything else when it comes to politics.
Well, he seemed to be a little bit, well, not a little bit, but rather paranoid, and, you know, you'd almost look at him too as
well,
Mr. Scrooge.
Well, that's why he had the Gang of Toughs. You know, he was running a plantation, and he had, you know, the great engineer who, you know, ran the place and let him wander off and get involved in other things. But I just, there were many people who actually ran that business in the background, even his son Edsel, who I would maintain probably knew more about modern car manufacturing than his father did. You know, they kept that place together. That's how it worked, ultimately.
Well, the big thing with his Model T is he thought the Model T was just going to be a car forever. And, you know, we're never going to produce other models or get into other things. He wanted it all black. You know, there's no options available. And as I read in your book, too, Sears offered the options that you could buy things aftermarket to turn it into a car of your choice.
Pages. Oh, it was one of the single biggest items in the Sears catalog 100 years ago. If you know, in the early teens, if you had been getting the catalog, there'd probably be 50, 100 pages. And to customize your Model T because you couldn't get any customization at the showroom. It was crazy. Ford missed a whole evolution of American consumerism. He just didn't notice. And, you know, when they finally had to stop making the Model T, they closed the plant for over a year, just in the late 1920s, 27. And there are many people who believe that that helped to cause the economic crash a few years later because it was very significant in Detroit, to put all those people out of work and make them live in the woods while you retool the factory. That's not very nice. So,
yeah, well, it was lack of planning, really. Like he never expected
no
he'd
planning.
Have to do that.
People would advance new ideas and get shot down by Henry Ford. Like my favorite, you know, it goes back to when I was a kid, was drum brakes. I think Ford was the last manufacturer to kind of give up on drum brakes. And they were cheap. That's why they kept using them. That's it. That ethic, you know, always, I think, dogged them and cost them a lot of money. Like, you know, one of the ways I got involved with writing about Ford was doing long magazine pieces on the Ford Explorer and the whole rollover mess and how that looked in Washington. I got to cover the hearings when Ford and Firestone got roasted over an open fire on Capitol Hill. And that was the first really big consumer fiasco for a major automaker, and it caused a lot of legislation to be passed such that if they did that today, those people would go to jail. But in the old days, they didn't have rules about such things. You didn't have to tell people that a product was clearly defective and that your engineers had told you that and that, no, this truck is not going to handle like a car, and if you put soft tires on it to compensate for the, you know, the stiff ride of a truck, that the thing is going to have stability issues. especially at highway speed. And that's exactly what they did. So,
and you have a higher center of gravity, too. I remember in the olden days when I was a peace officer, they gave the sergeants Dodge Ram 4x4s or something like that, and they rolled them over a lot.
Bronco.
Because
remember the Bronco? It was very wide, and same thing. If you didn't watch that thing in a, you know, a highway situation where you had to swerve, if it started to undulate, that car would just roll, you know. It would really take an experienced driver like a peace officer or somebody, you know, a truck driver, really, who understood that you should just let go of the wheel for a moment and let the thing settle down. But now most, you know, passenger car drivers would steer the other way, and that's going to make it roll.
Well, it's an amazing piece of history, especially when we go back and look at, what life was like back then, because all the things we take for granted now weren't in place. So, when Ford shut down that line to retool for the Model A, and you put, 60,000 people out of work directly from your plants, and then the ancillary jobs went up to like a 500,000, which were probably relatively well-paying, too. And, you starve. Like you got to be catching squirrels in the park or something like that if you want to get by, because you're going hungry. And that's what happened to people, is there was a giant hunger march, which would defy belief, I think, now for people today overall to realize that the economy in a region was hit so hard that, you're facing almost starvation. And
exactly. And in that period, you didn't really have a federal government, so everything was pretty much done at the state level. World War One had caused a bit of growth in the federal government, but it was only after the Depression and the war and the New Deal that you had all of these layers of shock absorber, if you will, put into place for things like unemployment. And other maladies. So, it was a terrible time in the mid-20s. People forget that.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, we're coming up for a break. We'll join you on the other side of the news. Thanks for coming to Power Our Nation and dealing with the Ford men with Christopher Whalen. Thank you.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Foods, Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Oxygen. It's nature's oldest therapy and plays an essential role in destroying viruses, bacteria, mold, yeast, and fungus, and keeping the human body healthy and strong. Now, you can give your body and your immune system a mega boost of disease-fighting oxygen with all-natural Oxy-C. With so many people now leading a sedentary indoor lifestyle, most are in a chronic state of oxygen deprivation, which sets up a perfect environment for disease, general fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Oxy-C is yours in simple, convenient capsules. Nothing to mix, nothing to hassle with. Take it with juice or water anytime. Feel a cold or flu approaching? Have no energy or spark anymore? Try all-natural Oxy-C and prepare to be amazed. Oxy-C is only available from New Earth Health Solutions at Rents.com. Look for the New Earth banner at Rents.com.
With dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Humana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Humana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America-made just for you. Food storage I love to eat. Yum!
If you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you'll know that Fukushima, the greatest calamity in history, has now, as I've been warning since 3/11, killed off virtually the whole North Pacific Ocean and especially up and down the entire West Coast. The radiation is migrating inland and is moving across the entire country. There's only one proven defender to radiation exposure, the brilliant Chernobyl-proven discovery of Dr. Michael Kiriak, which combines the four most potent and powerful algaes on the planet, imported to the U.S. and known as bio-superfood. I've taken bio-superfood every day for several years now and want you to do the same for your sake and the health and safety of your family and loved ones. Take the banner at the top of Rents.com and prepare to learn how to save your life.
Hi, it's Catherine from the Power Hour. If you're one of the many millions of people who have difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or having unrestful sleep throughout the night, REM sleep could be the solution you've been searching for. If you are like me and are afraid of the dangerous side effects from prescription sleep aids, REM sleep is an all-natural alternative that contains ingredients research has shown to help improve and enhance better sleep. REM Sleep will get you the deep sleep you need to feel your best and will ensure you wake up feeling energized. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today.
Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? Thepowermall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com today.
And we're back, Power Hour Nation. I'm your guest host from Canada, George Freund. Joining us today, Christopher Whalen, author of Ford Men, probably one of the most interesting little histories that you didn't get in school, really, but it's just charming with labor history, intelligence, espionage, manufacturing, invention. It's all rolled up into one little package that you can have a great trip down memory lane. And, I don't know, one thing that disturbs me about Mr. Ford is, he's supposed to have been a Christian, someone who goes to church and such. And I think if that was me, because, I'm a Christian and I believe in goodwill towards men, if I had that kind of money and that was my plant, I think it would be a much more different family-oriented environment than he had. I have ball diamonds around my factories, gardens, parks, maybe even have a Sunday afternoon barbecue for people and things like that to motivate and inspire people and kind of like they say, spread the word as opposed to hog the wealth. And, his legacy left us with something like you mentioned, the Dearborn Massacre, which is something I read in a book on machine guns when I never thought I'd be reading a book about labor history in the United States.
Yeah.
Any of these companies bought machine guns. So what happened with this culmination of at Dearborn?
Look, Henry Ford was a reflection of his age. He was as prejudiced as one might find really among the average American because, Catholics in this era were regularly ridiculed in newspapers and the Irish were compared to monkeys and enthralled them to the Church of Rome. So, bigotry and the, rough rhetoric of 100 years ago are very different from the standards of today. People would be shocked if they even saw the New York Times of 100 years ago today and how they referred to people as micks and wops and everything else. So you've got to look at it in context. But Ford was miserable. I'll give you a great example. I had mentioned before that James Cousins was really haunted by his wealth and how quickly it had amassed from virtually nothing. He had scraped up money from his family to invest in Ford Motor Company, and they got all their money back and more in year one. And, you know, I believe it was Cousins who actually raised wages for the workers at Ford. It wasn't Henry Ford. Henry Ford got credit for it. But I think it was Cousins who forced the issue, and I found the records from Ford's board of directors from that period, and I think it's very clear that Cousins was the one that proposed it. But he did it because it would help the business. He was all about helping the company, sure, selling cars, but I think he believed that if you paid the workers more, maybe they could buy a car. You know, even in the days when the Model T came out, it was priced, you know, in the hundreds and, you know, barely thousands of dollars. That was a vast amount of money for most people. And you mentioned earlier that Ford wasn't the first automaker. No, there were automakers in Europe that were making electric cars, and they had huge batteries the size of coffins. They're very expensive, you know, unimaginable for the average person. So I think the way I would look at Ford is he was a creature of his age, probably a little more prejudiced and bigoted than the average, and had a, you know, kind of typical hatred of Jews, blamed them for everything, and repented later. But I think, as I say, he saw in many different types of people flaws that he found unacceptable. He would lecture his workers about sobriety and about how they should live. But, you know, he himself lived very well, and he had a mistress and everything else, and, you know, he didn't have to follow his own rules. So Ford, you know, as I say, you should be critical of him because the degree he used his notoriety and his wealth for evil purposes, very certainly. But I think also, you know, overall the Ford family and those who came after Henry have been very public and very generous people. They only got in occasional trouble. There's no real scandal. Henry Ford II was probably the most interesting of them. You know, his famous dalliances with European royalty and getting arrested for drunk driving in California. But this was a guy who never had a childhood. He was barely old enough to buy a drink, and he had to take over the company in the middle of World War II right at the end. So he was forced to grow up really quickly and, you know, conducted himself quite well. He was a public figure, American royalty, really. And I think the Ford family that came after Henry, they definitely showed the polish and the intelligence of the girls. You know, Ford's wife and Edsel's wife, they were really tough, intelligent ladies who I think represented the family very well.
Well, as time went on, when the you know, the management of the company was being you know, flushed away a lot by Henry II, you know, they had a hard time finding you know, a keeper, more or less, and it seemed like their shining star was Lee Iacocca, and they ushered him out the door, and which, you know, ultimately saved Chrysler. But he seemed to be like the man, and he made a, you know, a prophecy as he went out the door. You're never going to see the $1.8 billion profits that you just had back to back ever again when I'm gone, because he seemed to be like the heart and soul of the company, and then they went into you know, losses for a period of years. Is that correct?
It is correct. Autos are a brutally cyclical business, and they're cyclical not just because sales go up and down, but because you as the automaker had to support your entire supply chain. So during World War II, when the government was paying automakers cost plus to make tanks and planes, they developed this huge infrastructure and overhead that was paid for. They didn't have to worry about the vagaries of the market. But as the automakers went through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and they had to rationalize, they had to essentially become private sector companies again and get rid of that public sector overhead that they developed during the war. When sales fell and you had this huge cost of supporting all your profit, you know, your parts makers with whatever liquidity you had, it could kill you in a couple of quarters. And both Ford and GM went through a couple of near misses during this period that were just, you know, it scared the hell out of people on Wall Street and in the banking industry to see how quick you could go from record profits to losing a ton of money. And all of them have periodically had to go through restructuring, to cut costs and this and that, and, you know, cut deals with their workers. But the reality is that you know, the industry could never afford a lot of the benefits, the retirement benefits and the health benefits that they awarded to their workers, but they gave it to them to buy peace. And that was kind of one of the sadder parts of the book, was telling that story and just, you know, making people understand that these are just industrial companies that make machines. And the profits are good when they're good, and when they're bad, they're really bad. And that's why today you have three or four companies that make transmissions. All the major auto groups now cooperate on engines and things like this because it's expensive. And in order to finance the development and the research that goes into new products, it's hard. So you look at someone like Tesla, who's brand new and very innovative, you know, very charismatic founder, but they're trying to get into an industry which is very difficult to make money, even for the giants. So I think it's a somewhat irrational industry. I actually asked Bill Ford once, I said, if you could get all the family's money back, would you invest in the auto industry? And he said, oh, of course, because he's a sweet guy. And again, very generous with his community and, you know, just in general. And yet, you know, honestly, the single-digit returns, if you're lucky, that you get from autos, you could do better. It's a very risky business, and it's a business where a lot of governments and a lot of countries want to have their own industry. So the Chinese, the Koreans, you know, the Indians, the Brazilians, they all wanted to have their own local domestic company. So it's hard for the, you know, the larger automakers to really get and maintain a foothold in a market like that. So, you know, it's fascinating that way. You could do lots of studies on the auto sector, but it's still basically a transformational business where you have to control most of your suppliers, and that's expensive.
Well, one of the downsides for Ford was, of course, they made some of the most notorious garbage wagons that were ever manufactured as well. You know, the Pinto being at the top of the list, I guess, and then the Maverick wasn't that great either. I had a friend who had a Maverick. He could almost drop a suitcase through the door without opening it for the rust holes in the car after a while. And they were, you know, I was looking on the Canadian Auto Trader site just to see what's left for some of them. There were three Model Ts, 12 Model A's, there was like six Fairlanes, 18 Galaxies, there wasn't one Pinto, there wasn't one Maverick anywhere in Canada to be found for sale.
No.
On the
you
big
guys
thing.
Use too much salt on the roads, I mean, forget it. Just,
yeah, they just evaporated, but, you know, this Pinto was quite the dangerous thing. Can you explain a little bit about, you know, what they did and what they didn't do to make it such a crisis?
Well, the positioning of the gas tank made it more likely that you would have an explosion and a fire in the event of a rear-end collision. So this was pointed out to the folks at Ford, and they fought it. They would just let the lawyers deal with it, and eventually they had to, you know, actually come and redesign the fuel tank and reposition it. But it was a... See, in those days, Ford was starving. You mentioned Lee Iacocca, right? The Mustang, the Pinto, the Maverick, all of these cars were these derivative efforts by a company that only had an entry-level product. You know, Lincoln had been the love child of Edsel Ford, and they never really developed it fully into a line that could compete with Cadillac, which, you know, was very well established. It was kind of the top of the food chain at GM. You as an executive or, you know, any sort of middle-class American in those days, you could work your way up the offering of Chevys and Oldsmobiles and finally Cadillacs, right? And they had different pricing and different features. At Ford, you just had one. You had basic and a little fancier than basic, and that's it. So they were constantly struggling to maintain a competitive position vis-a-vis Chevrolet. You didn't even talk about General Motors when you compared Ford. You just talked about Chevy versus Ford. And so, you know, the Pinto was a very cheap, basic vehicle that I remember quite well. And, you know, it reflected that. It just was not that well made or well designed. It certainly didn't have the consumer protection thought process reflected in the design the way you would have today. You know, you have cars today that are among the biggest sellers that are lighter and arguably more dangerous than a Pinto in some circumstances, But they have designed in so many safety features that it's acceptable. You know, your typical small car, not a midsize, but a small car in today's market in the U.S., you don't want to get in a crash in one of those because they're very light. There's no mass to absorb the impact. The Pinto was clunky, you know. It was made out of sheet metal practically.
A pop can with four wheels.
Oh, God, yeah, it was just perfect for a big explosion from a badly positioned gas tank, yeah. You know, there was nothing to protect the gas tank in the back. So if you hit it hard enough and you drove the metal supports, they could pierce the tank, you know, if you hit the bumper hard enough. So it's like, oh, God. So, but, you know, they had other winners like the Explorer and the Bronco. I know a lot of lawyers who made a fortune representing personal injury cases on Explorers and Broncos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They should send a Christmas card to the Fords every year.
Oh, my.
In fact, the cases involving the Explorer were so numerous that the courts actually had to appoint a special forum in Indianapolis that would certify all the class action cases that were brought against Ford on the Explorer. And the only other time you see situations like that is asbestos, all the different companies that have had to pay asbestos claims. And, you know, it was a remarkable phenomenon to see that. And if you know, things like Pinto could have easily been like that, but they happened earlier. And you didn't have the sensitivity to consumer product defects that you had even by the time we get to the Explorer. You know, and it's increased, you know, order of magnitude since then.
Indeed. And then, too, like Henry was big on, you know, using his muscle where he could, too. You know, part of it was good as he would distribute his wealth to all sorts of banks to keep them solvent and to spread it around. And then by the same token, when he started to become under pressure with the administration at the time, he threatened to pull all his money out of banks to, you know, basically cause them to collapse. And that may have been the result of the big bank collapse in 1933. What was going on there?
Well, one of the things that had always fascinated me about Ford was my research on the Great Depression, and especially looking at the memoir of Herbert Hoover, Jesse Jones's great book, $50 Billion. Jones was the man who restructured the U.S. economy in the 30s with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And you summarized it nicely. Ford was one of the wealthiest men in the United States, certainly in Detroit, and he was one of the biggest cash depositors of the big banks in Detroit. And Detroit was huge in those days. It was at least as big as New York as a financial center. So one day, early in 1933, in between when the election had occurred and when FDR took office in March, remember, we waited 4 months in between. They changed that after the 30s, of course. Ford decides, after talking with Cousins and others and having a fair amount of back and forth with President Hoover, that he's going to take his money out of the bank and everybody can be damned. And it was one of the more ridiculous episodes by Henry Ford, because he said, you know, if the world collapses, I will rebuild, like he had done this all by himself, which was totally untrue. So Cousins at the last moment, you know, with Secretary Ballantyne and all these other figures from the Hoover administration, trying to talk him down off the ledge, he rejects it. And meanwhile, Edsel Ford had been using his own money to support the Detroit Trust Company. He was so public-minded and so different from his father that he had broken with him. He said, no, fine, I'm going to do what I can to help our community. But unfortunately, the governor of Michigan found out about all this, and he declared a bank holiday, Governor Comstock, and that was it. The banks in Detroit closed. They stayed closed for most of the year, if you can imagine that. And by the time FDR takes office in New York in March of 33, every bank in the country is closed. And I think it would have happened anyway. The banking crisis was kind of the follow-on to the crash in 29, and things moved very slowly in those days, not like we have today. But I think Ford precipitated a crisis that didn't need to unfold the way it did. And if he had not been so selfish and so short-sighted, FDR might have taken office ahead of a banking crisis, and he might have been able to sit down with people like Jesse Jones, a number of other people in Washington who were focused on the problem but didn't know what to do. You know, people forget that Hoover set up the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but he didn't know what to do with it. And he fortunately had this southerner from Arkansas named Jesse Jones who did know, and he did know how to fix banks, and he did know how to organize people and get things done. And he was one of the great men of that period. But, you know, Ford really was just acting like a child and was so different from his son Edsel, who, you know, sadly died a very tragic and early death. But the 30s are not a good chapter for Henry. Of all the stupid things he did in his life, to me, just as a historian, this is probably the worst, and it's one of the least understood. You won't hear them talking about this at the Ford Museum.
Oh, definitely not. That's what makes your book a treasure, is there's little pieces of information in there that just open up massive doors about what really happened back then. And I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, who survived the Depression, and how bad things were. And from my earliest age, you know, he was teaching me how to snare rabbits, because, you know, after you live through something like that, where, you know, basically, you know, with a bank closure, no money, no jobs, no hopes or anything like that, you're back to a hunting and gathering society practically. And, you know, everywhere he went, he had a garden. That's the first thing you put in a house, a cold storage room, just, you know, just filled with all sorts of preserves my grandmother would put away in there, because he was never going to go hungry again. And, you know, he rolled the rails looking for work in other places, and, you know, told me he'd go without food for days on end, you know, hoping you could just pick up a little bit of work here or there, even something small, just so you could get a couple of, you know, who knows, maybe dollars at best to come home and feed your family. It's, you know.
Oh, no, that's right. Just like my grandparents here in New York, they all lived through that. My dad was born in 35, so he remembers.
Indeed, that's one of the big reasons why I like to do media and such like that, is to give a giant history lesson to people and just give them a reminder about, you know, how thankful you should be for what you got now, because we're doing so much better than they had to do in the past. And they had to survive it, and they did, and they raised their children and grandchildren. And, you know, here we are to talk about it and reminisce. But, you know, life can be difficult and tough, and it can just take one big mistake from a small group of people or an individual to just, you know, turn us into the wind and destroy us. And we have to pick up the pieces.
Well, it's always good to remember what happened before. You know, the Roman parallels with where the United States is getting to be more and more painful. You know, especially financially. But, you know, I think, unfortunately, societies often outgrow their ability to actually provide real jobs and real growth to their people. And it's not at all unlike where we were exactly 100 years ago. And in the very end of World War One, after the Europeans stopped buying, you know, stuff to kill one another, in 1918, the economy really slowed down. And if you read Galbraith's great book about the crash, if you read his book about the Florida land speculation, the rest of the U.S. was kind of okay. The agricultural sector went through a terrible deflation and the Dust Bowl and everything else. And, you know, it was a tough time. And if you can imagine Ford shutting down that plant in 27, when it was already difficult for people to find work, inflation was a big issue in the major cities because of costs rising faster than wages. It was a very tough time, and not unlike the debate you hear today, when people are out talking about issues that matter to them economically. It's very similar, actually.
Well, how do you look at some of the economic news in today's paper with the markets taking a bit of a beating and such like that? Do you think we're in for just a little short haul or more of a long haul?
Well, look, the Fed, I think, had a near miss in December. They were not paying attention to market indicators. They were all still looking at their DSGE models, which is, you know, what the folks on the staff of the Fed in Washington use to try and guess what the economy is going to do. And they ignored the fact that credit spreads, which to me are the most important indicator, started to widen, which means marginal, you know, junk kind of companies, where can they borrow money? And when that gets more than about 3.5 points above treasury bonds, the market just stops. And we saw a drop in issuance activities across the board in December, which was scary. The markets just stopped working. And I think that's why Chairman Powell had to pivot so quickly and say, well, we're not going to raise rates anymore. And by the way, we're going to stop shrinking the Fed's balance sheet, which was also pressuring the credit markets in that period. So, you know, now we had a rally for almost exactly a quarter at the very end of April. We were kind of done with that. And ever since then, rates, you know, the 10-year treasury and the 30-year mortgage, which is what I look at, been going sideways. We still haven't made back on financials, the banks, which I look at very carefully, where we were a year ago. We're still down slightly. So we're kind of dancing sideways in terms of the markets. And I don't think the Fed knows what to do. I think they are, you know, they had to come out the other day and say that they don't feel like, you know, they have to change anything at the moment. And it's because a lot of the indicators they use are telling them different things that conflict. Employment's strong, but you can look at other indicia and you can start to be a little bit worried, particularly home prices, which I think are going to start to adjust down, especially the more expensive real estate, which is where all the building has been for the past 5 years.
Okay, so well, we thank you for that briefing very much. We're coming to the end of the rope here on our hour. And a marvelous, marvelous history lesson on the Ford men. We thank you very much, Christopher. And Power Hour Nation will be back tomorrow with myself. So God bless you all. And until tomorrow, we'll hold with bated breath to talk to Jack Mullen. Thanks for coming out.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Dr. Joe Schneller.
The efficacy that we're looking for, that we're going to prove, is that Carnivora wakes up this immune system and makes it dominant.
I highly recommend that you get started right away using Carnivora because it really will help you. Just follow the directions as the company gives them to you. And I just want everybody to know that there's been no one paid to do this. I'm doing this on my own because I care about everybody and want to see healthy people.
My husband has recovered tremendously after the physician suggested that he start taking Carnivora. When he was doing so well, I decided to start taking it as well, and we're both so pleased to be able to feel healthy again.
Hello, folks. Richard Ostro of Carnivora Research International here. Visit carnivora.com or call 1-866-VENUS-FLY. That's carnivora.com or 1-866-VENUS-FLY. Call us today.